that's the course I'm going to teach you. Okay. I'm going to assume that you basically got calculus under your belt. That's not necessarily multidimensional or differential equations. So I'll be assuming that you're doing that kind of stuff. I'll set you through that. I'm assuming you know what an integral is. It's not a math class, so doing integrals wouldn't necessarily be that bad, but we probably will be doing some. I expect you to know basic mechanics and electromagnetism. Okay, so the electromagnetism that we do all be sort of starting with Maxwell's equation. Alright. So we have a lot of fun stuff to do. Now, I think in this class you're a bit of a mix of students coming from different angles. So my guess is some of you will all find bits and pieces of this very boring and bits and pieces of this very cool. And so I don't know what to say. I know we have some optics majors in here, right? How many of those? All right. We're going to do geometric optics. Same lenses. Two lenses. Tell me, you know, where the image is and how big it is. My guess is that's going to bore you guys to tears. All right. How many chemists? Any chemistry majors? Anybody took chemistry? All right. So we're going to do a little bit of, orbitals and putting electrons and multi-electron atoms and stuff. So you may find some of that boring if you've done it. Probably lots of stuff none of you have ever seen. And we'll even do possibly some things that are not in gene cult. So the course is primarily waves and modern physics. All right. So we're going to start out with a little relativity because the standard place to start is waves, but then I'd be doing some harmonic motion today, and I just couldn't bring myself to do that too. So we're going to start with some relativity, but then we're going to do waves, and waves are just really important because they're at the core of optics and quantum mechanics and electromagnetism in many ways. So we're going to do waves, and some of that I hope will be a repeat for many of you to some extent, but I hope to go a bit deeper both in perhaps some of the things that we typically cover and probably in terms of formality and notation and stuff, because we will use a different notation for waves in quantum mechanics than we typically use in the introductory physics sequences. So we'll do a lot of stuff. So the stuff I have labeled here are what I consider to be sort of the core pieces of the course that we really are responsible to do. And then at the end, I have listed a bunch of different things. Because I think I understand if you took this 120 sequence, you haven't seen fluids, is that right? And you haven't seen thermal and statistical mechanics, right? Okay, so you really should see those things, okay, and we can do them if we need to, so I consider that sort of hole filling if we need to. If I were doing just this class and not worrying about that, then I would probably go from nuclear physics into particle physics, a little cosmology, and some, you know, really weird stuff for fun. Right, at that point, I'm probably not going to test you on it, but we'll just have fun with it. But I really only have a few classes at the end if you looked at the syllabus. So at some levels, we start getting later in the course, I'm simply going to probably conduct a survey of you guys and try to figure out what you'd like me to do with those classes. It's possible if we get bogged down here that we actually lose those classes. So. Okay? So that's the nature of the class. You should have received an email from me yesterday that went out to the Blackboard listing that I have. So if you're officially in the class, you should have gotten that email. If you are not officially signed up for the class and you did not get the email, you want to officially sign up for the class, but that's my way of sending you an email. At any rate, if you did get that email, you have this link in there, which is the link to the website that I control on the physics server, so it's a lot easier to use actually than Blackboard. So I will use that for posting many things like your assignments and the solution sets and things like that. So you'll want to get this link if you didn't get that email yesterday, because you can pick up a copy of the syllabus there. But this is my contact info. And I will use Blackboard certainly as a way to report grades to you, and also sometimes I may be doing for some of the weird topics some external readings that are copyright protected, so I'll put them there. Just in terms of how the evaluation is done, this is sort of an analytical problem-solving class, so that's really what the grade is. There is an associated lab, and that's about all you'll ever hear me say about it. It's being run separately, basically. It will, I hope, cover some of the same topics, but we don't try really hard to structure the lecture so that it's timed perfectly. So my guess is some of it will be timed very well for you in terms of where you are and questions you know to ask, and some will not. And so that's probably not ideal. It's just not a bad level on the site. So whatever the lab grade is, it will get handed to me. I will then factor that in on a scale of 100 as 15% of your grade. The other catch with that is if you don't do all the labs, I don't give you a grade in the class. So it would be an incomplete potential. But they do have makeup times and stuff like that, so just make sure you do that. We will do problem sets. So how I do problem sets may be a little different from what you normally see. You guys are, let's see, let me ask, how many freshmen are in here? Okay. And of you freshmen, how many of you took 122? So how many of you took, 142? 141. So the freshmen raise their hands. How many of you have actually had 11 magazines? High school? Alright. I'm going to have to think about that one. There's a point about one third of the semester you're going to go, what? Okay. So, I was going to crack on freshmen. We've got a lot of them in here. If you took 141, I mean, I assume you know, to get through this stuff, you need to be doing your homework. Right? So, I'm not going to take your homeworks up, and I'm not going to have you input them into a computer and grade them, or have the computer tell you you got or didn't get the right answer. Okay? I'm actually about you doing the work to beat your head against it, trying to figure it out, and then checking yourself that you sort of know what's going on. Alright? So, I'll just state it bluntly. If you don't do the homework religiously and keep up with the class, I'm going to completely kick your ass in this class. Okay? And that's just a promise. Okay? So, don't be stupid and let them go. So, in that spirit, I'm going to give you problem sets every week, and I'm going to expect you to do them, and I'm going to ask that you hand them in. And we are going to track that, okay? But rather than use all my TA manpower sitting there slogging through and grading your homeworks and giving you feedback, or taking care of web work and making sure it's working whenever it's not working, okay? I would rather than spend time with you, contact time, and workshops and office hours and that kind of thing. So, you want to do the homeworks, hand them in. The deadline will be whenever my TA comes in on Friday morning and opens the box and pulls them out. Okay? Whatever time that is. I will tell the TA not to do that before like 5 or 6 a.m. I wasn't real concerned that would happen. But just so you know. So get it in by Thursday night sometime in the locker, which is down by Balsamone 106. Anybody not know where that is? Alright, so if you go into Bausch & Lomb, off the quad, you turn right and go downstairs on the right-hand stairwell. At the base of that, we'll see some ugly lockers on one side and an lecture hall, Bausch & Lomb 106, and it's an entrance to the tunnels. And so there'll be, one of the lockers will have Physics 123 listed on that. And so that's where you want to shove your homework. Okay? TA is going to pick it up there Friday, whenever they do. Okay, so to be safe, you want to get it in Thursday night. The TAs, what my instructions will be then, to them will be to look through the problem set basically as a measure for effort. If all you do is give me a sheet with answers on it, it doesn't count. You're not doing anything. So show me your work. We're not actually checking to see that you got the right answer. That's not actually the goal. The goal is for you to work through the process and work out kinks. So the solution, I mean, if I were just after the answer, then all you care about is a solution. And if you don't know how to Google those by now, what can I do? I put them in the library, the TAS library. The solutions are there. The point of the homework isn't that you get the right answer and give it to me and I check it and give you a percent, right? The point of it is for you to do it and see what you understand and don't understand in the process of how you solve these problems and make a list of everything you're not understanding and make sure you get that straightened out. That's the process, okay? So go through that. And if in the process of that you want to go check the solution in the library, do that. If you don't, that's fine. We will hand out solutions. I'll post them probably. I have to think a little bit about how good the solutions are in the solution manual. For the lower level courses, I usually make much more explicit solutions as we start to get to more advanced, and I consider this class beginning to be more advanced. Sometimes the problem is the publisher's solutions are a little cryptic and you have to work a little to figure it out, but that's maybe good for you at this stage, so I'll have to do that. So that you'll get solutions and you need to come to closure on the solutions. When you hand in the problem set, that may be really only part of the job. You really need to make sure that you understand the solutions that we lay out. They may be different from yours. I hope by now most of you realize there are multiple ways to do problems that can be right. Right? In mechanics, you can use energy conservation, you use the kinematics equations. And when students are first getting started, it's like, which way is the right way? And they don't really lie there uncomfortable with it. Well, they're both right. It's fine. So, you know, so you have to come to closure and make sure you understand what you did and what the solutions are and fill any holes in your understanding of that. So that's your responsibility, all right? All I'm going to ask is that we look at your problem set. How did that happen? We look at your problem set and we see that you put in effort. Okay? And if we see that, you get it. If it looks like you really didn't put any effort, then not. So there's a little bit of a subjective call about that. At any rate, there will be something like 12 assignments, and we're going to count 9 of those. So you can miss 3 without it hurting your grade. And in terms of handing them in, I told you what the deadline is. That's what the deadline is. Okay? Please don't email me or come to me Friday and tell me all the wonderful reasons that you were on your way over to hand it in and you got tripped by a dog and rolled down the hill and got run over by a truck and then got mugged on your way and never made it. Okay? I don't care. But I mean, I'm sorry if that's what happened to you. I wish it were better reasons. You know, I met some really cool looking dude or girl and, you know, one thing led to another and I didn't do my homework. Fine. I'm happy with that, okay? I don't even know about it. I sort of set it up. All right, if you don't get it in when the TA fix it up, it's just late. I don't care. Because I don't want to spend time negotiating with people. All right. The other thing is about the drops. The drops are the drops. I'm not going to micromanage. I'm not going to make a judgment as to when you have a good reason or a bad reason. You do it when you need to do it. you know, my advice is to just, your goal should be get them all in, because then you want to be given the homework, you want to do it regularly, you want to keep up in the class, and that's good. That way you have a drop when you need to for an emergency. So I'm fine with that. So I'm trying to give you a little flexibility. All right? The same is sort of true with the exams. Most of the grade comes from the exams. But what I'm doing is I'm setting it up so that I will evaluate the grade one of three ways. One way, I sort of put a fairly even weight amongst the exams with a slightly higher weight on the final. The other way is I actually throw out one of the term exams and weight the others up accordingly. All right. So what this does is it provides you the flexibility to miss an exam or have a really bad day. And you don't have to tell me about it, and I don't have to make any judgments, because I'm going to evaluate everybody's grade all three ways, and then I'm going to take the one that gives the highest number. Okay? So it just happens automatically. So if you have to miss an exam, I hope it's for fun reasons rather than not fun reasons. My advice is you take them all, because then it allows you to sort of have a bad day and gives you the flexibility. But if you decide to blow one off, I don't really want to hear about it when you then have an emergency. Okay, so you want to be careful. Okay. Any questions on that? Okay, so the other thing about this, especially since I allow a drop here, there is a distinct possibility that the different exams will be different in difficulty. So I really have to normalize that out so that there's no dependence on, oh, I got sick in exam one, I got sick in exam two. Well, exam two is a whole lot harder than exam one, so therefore it's great. You know, we can't have that. So because of that dropping, I have to have some mechanism to try to take out the first order. You're going to be like physicists and engineers mostly, right? All right, so you got to learn to use these expressions. And I'm going to take out the first order. It's very important. I'm going to be teaching you these kinds of things. So you have to learn when and when not to say, we can show trivially that. Okay? You have to use it at just the right times to have the right impact. So, all right. So to first order, I have to take this out. And the way that I do that is I simply take the distribution for each exam, and they may have different means, okay? And I'll simply normalize those means up to 100. So I'll multiply everybody's exam by 100 over the mean for that exam. So it basically takes the distributions and it puts them right on top of each other at 100. Okay? And that then basically is what I feed in as exam grades that we then calculate the final average with. Once I have the final average, I will have some distribution, okay, which will be have a mean roughly, you know, somewhere near 100, okay, but it will be some distribution. And I will then place letter grades on top of that. Alright, and you might say, but where are the letter grades going to be? And I said, well, that's what I can pay for. So I don't know what to say. I don't have a quota. I have some idea of what kind of work I expect you to be doing. If everybody really does phenomenal work, everybody will get an A. If everybody really sucks, then they'll get an A. Alright, so that's how it's going to work. But that said, you shouldn't be too freaked out about it, because on average, you know, if you're a kind of class I'm expecting, usually the mean of the exam will be around D, and the B will be fairly tall. And I'll give you some input about that at each exam, but I don't have an absolute scale. I can tell you that it is typical, and it is my intent, for most exams to have a mean at around 65 to 70. And I do that because I find that if I have a mean much higher than that, I actually lose discrimination power on really good students. I can't really tell A's from B pluses. And if I have a mean significantly lower than that, I completely lose track of people who are having some trouble in the course that probably should be at about a C level, and the people who just started to bring it. I can't tell the difference when the mean is at 50. Okay, so I find if I put the mean at around 65-ish or so, then I feel comfortable with that. questions? Quiet bunch. All right.
What else do we have here?
So one part of this class will be what I call a workshop. I don't know, they may have been listed as recitation sections or whatever for you. They're basically 2-hour periods, roughly 2 hours, where you'll get in a room with something like 12-ish of your colleagues here, and you'll work on problems that I make up. And you'll have a facilitator in there who'll be one of the TAs in the class. And the idea with this is that they won't give you answers. You're sort of to be doing it yourself. They're there to facilitate that happening. The process is for you to basically be working together, ask lots of questions, work with each other. If you're really, really good and you think this is a waste of your time, actually, if you're in there helping the other students, you'll find that you get a whole lot out of it. So I actually would encourage you to go. You sign up for sections. We're sort of doing load leveling at some level, so I'm happy for you to stay in that section. I do find, though, even at sizes of 12 or so, you can be victims of statistics. You may find yourself in a section where so many people are so quick at what they're doing that you're getting short-circuited in your thinking. If that's true, you may want to change sections. Or the other way around. Okay, so you have to sort of find a section that works for you, but give it a couple of goes first. Okay. I'm hoping for this class, if you've done enough of this stuff, that you know this is probably a good idea, but I do happen to have some data, so I'll go ahead and tell you this. This methodology, you may not realize because it's sort of it's pretty common here in science classes, but the typical pattern in big lecture classes is to throw about 30 of you in a room, put a TA up in front of you who looks at you and goes, any questions? And some people come and some people ask questions, but it's not particularly good learning experience. So what we're doing is we've institutionalized sort of a research group, basically where everybody gets in a room and you can all sort of work together and ask questions. And you don't have somebody up front lecturing. I hope you come to lecture and everything, but many of you will not learn a lot in lecture because my job is to sort of paint a pretty picture for you. Okay, but your real learning happens when you're having to paint the picture for yourself, which happens when you do problem sets and it happens in workshop. The focus in workshop is more on how do you paint the picture. You've got to identify the problems you're having and figure out how long it goes about doing the problems. Just to emphasize, when I started this thing out, actually, in 1999, I had a class of about 200 students in Physics 114. And I did a prototype of this workshop with about 41 students, and the others we had in normal recitation. And what I found was that in those students who went to over half the workshops, 93% of them made B-minus or better. If I took the rest of the class, only 63% of them made B-minus or better. And that impressed me very much. And so then we went to full-scale workshops in physics. So I have a lot of data from different classes. This one is particularly important because we actually had a random split in the class. Everybody wanted to do workshops. I just took the 40 that I had room for. And so I thought it was pretty interesting. So the rest of the years, we had all workshops. So all I could do was correlate grades with attendance in workshop. But when I did, I found that, in fact, again, those who went to over half the workshops made significantly better grades than those who went to less than half the workshop. Okay? This class may be a little different. This is 113, 121, 114. I'm hoping you guys are a little more mature and it might be a little less of an issue, but if you want to blow something off in this class, that's not what you want to blow off. Okay? Alright, so there are lots of components to the class. You should do them. You should ask questions along the way. Alright, you're welcome to ask questions in here. Thou shalt strive to understand what is behind the problems and what thou dost wrong on them. Right? If you're just doing them to hand something in, it's not going to do you any good. Generally in physics, it's not a good idea to cram. Again, I'm hoping you guys all know this. I really get annoyed when a student comes to me the day before the final and starts talking about how they didn't do so well in exams one and exam two, and I talk to them and go, so, well, they're not doing any homework. It's too late for me to do anything. All right, so if you're having problems in the class, I prefer that you come to me earlier than later. I can at least try to help. So I think the most important things really are do the problems in the workshops and don't cram. Other things, if you're not on Blackboard, please get that way. I believe we will start workshops week after next, because we've got one class this week, one class next week, so we really haven't got enough in our belt to do much. I tend to like to have a material and workshop run a little bit behind what we're doing in lecture. Sometimes it's hard to keep the synchronization between the lecture, what's in the problem sets, and the workshops all the way that I like it. The way I tend to try to do it is to have the problem set material and the workshop material, I'm sorry, the lecture material and the problem set material to go very close to one another. Hopefully I get the lecture first if we are really sitting doing the problems, and workshops running about a week later to work out. That's what I try to do. I will screw it up sometimes for different reasons. It's really okay to hit material for the first time in any one of the three. You got to do all three. It doesn't really matter. All right, so just don't worry about it. Synchronization. Just try to do the best you can. But you're doing different things, and the problem sets the workshops down. I haven't put up concept one yet, but I'll try to do that very soon so we can get going on that. Lab start time information will come out to you, but I don't have that for you quite yet. Okay? So that's the deal with the class. Yes?
There's, I think, a lab or a lab lecture section on Wednesday. Is that not happening?
My guess is it isn't. I don't think labs start yet. But that's a guess. Yes.
Is the first one we're going to do next week?
Probably the week after, but I have to think through that. I have to think about what it is. See, part of the problem is I kill a lot of this class just talking about the class in general, so we're not going to end. We're going to do a lot of conceptual stuff today, so I'm not really going to start getting the meat of even relativity until next week. But. Okay. Anything else about class in general? Okay, so follow on details. Next Monday is Martin Luther King Day, so no classes. Next Wednesday, we will not have class here. I will be out of town. I will post slides and an audio file online on the class website. And you just, get your favorite beverage, put on your PJs, and there we go. All right, if you're lucky, I'll do the whole class and Martin Luther King speech. I have a dream! I have a dream! That those who have been in the darkness of ignorance about space time will find themselves realizing that it is a fabric of life, etc. Maybe not. So generally, when I do this, these makeup, these sort of things where I do the online. Hello? Okay. Generally, students are okay with it. I think it works pretty well for them. I don't get complaints. What I will tell you, though, is that your beverage of choice, maybe should be coffee, because generally when I do these, I'm talking to myself in a dark room somewhere. And it's hard to make them entertaining. So sometimes it depends on whether I maybe had wine with dinner or not, but okay. All right, anything else about the class? Okay, so let's talk a little bit about relativity. to start. You guys are pros on mechanics now. What's time? A made up quantity. A made up quantity used to measure events. How do you know time exists? How do you know you need to make something like that? Say again?
It's empirical from the existence of change.
Okay. Empirical from the existence of change. That's pretty good. If you worry about whether time exists or not, just imagine how much fun this class would be if time didn't exist. I mean, I might be boring. It may feel like it takes forever to get out of here, but imagine if time just stopped. How would you know? Nothing would happen. We live in a universe that's constantly changing, so we have to have time to quantify that change. So time is the fabric in which we define when things happen. It also allows us to put in some ordering because we believe that there is causality between many things. And so we use time to sort of allow us to. Time has a role to play in American causality. So what about space? Think about that a little bit. the worldview that you use to solve problems in Physics 121 is that you can locate things like the balls and the rockets and the sleds or whatever it is you're dealing with three numbers, and then you have time, okay? And your view of these things is such that space is three immutable dimensions, right? With infinite distances. So you have the three dimensions of space that fill our entire universe. And this whole thing basically marches in one direction in time at a constant rate. And that marching through time at a constant rate is the same for us as it is for somebody in San Francisco. It's the same for us as it is for somebody who's flying over an F-16. Right? You all agree with this. That's good, because I don't want to be anywhere near you on the road if you don't totally buy into that. Okay? So, we're all agreed, this is our vision of space-time. It's a freaking lie. We got one on you. That is the right view of space-time. And our basic physics is built on it. It is the view of space-time you need to have to exist in the world in which you live. Okay? But let's now examine a little bit more carefully and see what comes out. Okay, so we're all agreed on space and time. So if we just take this and we extrapolate a little bit, let's imagine, you know, that I'm jogging along at 4 miles per hour. And let's say that you're in an airport, okay? So you see some dude jogging along at 4 miles per hour, and he goes and gets on a... measure 4 miles per hour. And then he steps onto a moving sidewalk that is moving at 2 miles per hour. And you're off to the side. He doesn't break stride when he gets on this thing. How fast is he going with respect to you? 6. Okay. Velocities are additive. That's the world in which we live. Alright, so now let's suppose I'm in a car and I take a flashlight or a laser beam, and the car's movement velocity V this way, okay? And I take the flashlight and I fire it out in front. The car's moving this way, okay? How fast is that light going? What? I'm sorry?
The speed of the plus the car.
You seem confused. Are you sure you took physics 121?
That's not fair.
Huh?
That's not fair.
No!
Depends on who. Wait, who are we observing?
You're off to the side. There's the car.
Can't go back.
Who says that? But we live in a Newtonian world. Alright? So Newton's answer is pretty unambiguous with this. The speed of light needs to go C plus D this way. Okay. C minus D that way. And C this way. If C is the speed of light when it's at rest with respect to when its source is at rest. Alright? That's what your basic physics tells you has to be the case. And it's really the same as a person and a sidewalk. Alright, so it's the problem is that when you go and you do the experiment, and this is true for all mechanical waves. You don't actually see that. This was first shown by Michelson and Morley, pre-Einstein, where they took coherent light and they performed an interference experiment where they split the light along that path and along that path, and you've probably seen interference or will be doing it later. But basically, you can, when you recombine the light, you can actually tell within fractions of the wavelength of light differences in the distances, or if you have that calibrated out, differences in the speed. So they are able to actually look at, along orthogonal axes, and they were able to see that they couldn't. They had no evidence of any different speed. And they were able to sample this in all directions, basically by having it on Earth and having Earth rotate and go around the sun. So what this means is that light does not appear to travel in some, I mean, what people had thought was that light somehow, because we are only aware of things like mechanical waves, waves that move on strings, things that vibrate in air, things in a medium. With light, as we'll find out if you didn't see it already, the wave is oscillating electric and magnetic fields. And the idea was, because we could not conceive of something that didn't have a medium, was that light moved through something called the ether. Ether being medium, ether being ethereal, because you don't really notice it. And obviously light was traveling through something, so therefore it must be ethereal. So that's why we call it the ether. But that would mean that the universe is filled with this ether and that you just move through it all the time. And you would then expect there to be a velocity dependence depending on your direction of movement through the ether. So, for example, if the ether is at rest with respect to the universe or whatever, and we're on Earth moving this way through the ether, then just like if I took a pond and I threw a pebble right here into the water, if I ran this way, the speed of the waves relative to me would be different than they would be if I ran this way, right? So once you put the wave in a mechanical medium, you expect to see directional dependence in this law, which is basically another statement that you should see C plus B if you're in a car going this way, C minus B going that way, C. And that's not what they saw. Okay? So there was a lot of fretting about that because something's broken, right? That this is really strange. And so Einstein came along, and Einstein, you know, he's the prototypical brilliant person. You know, your friends want to give you a hard time because you got the problem, oh, you're an Einstein, whatever, right? The funny thing, and no doubt he's a very smart guy, but the funny thing is, I actually think Einstein's greatest talent was his ability to see the obvious when most people couldn't. And this is an example of that. There was a lot of worrying, people were trying to figure out, maybe as the Earth moves through the ether, it sort of drags the ether along so that there's no motion with respect to the ether, and therefore you don't detect it when you do this experiment. So things started to get very complicated in looking at it that way. Einstein came in and said, maybe the experiment's just right. Let's just assume it's right and just see what happens. So let's do that, okay? So Einstein made two postulates. One is that this experiment is correct. As weird as it seems, it's just simply right, okay? In which case, we say the speed of light is the same in all inertial reference frames. Okay. I use a fancy word there, inertial. What we mean by inertial here is that it is a reference frame. You take reference frames? All right, so I want you to get in the habit of thinking of everybody with sort of this reference frame stuck to them. Right? So If I'm at rest with respect to you, we basically are using the same reference frame. If I'm moving at some 30 miles per hour going past, then you can think of me having this reference frame moving with respect to you at 30 miles per hour. But the thing is, we're only dealing with reference frames that move with respect to one another at constant speed in special relativity. This is the special in special relativity. If you violate that, if you have an accelerated reference frame, which can be, you know, speeding up or turning, that is rotating, then special relativity doesn't work. You have to then use the generalization of it, which is general relativity. Okay? So this is special. Okay, so the speed of light is the same in all inertial reference frames. And the second assumption of reference frames for the point of view of the observer, the second assumption I think we can't really argue with either, which is that whatever happens essentially has to happen in all of the reference frames. So if I have an egg and I drop it and it breaks on the floor, everyone, no matter what your reference frame is, sees the egg in my hand, and then later sees the egg broken on the floor. Okay? So the way that I put it is I say the physics is the same in each of these inertial reference frames. So these are the two basic postulates of Einstein makes. Okay? And if you believe my assumption morally, then these aren't a big deal. So now let's just look at the implications. What I'd like to do is to consider a situation where we have like a truck going by with speed V. The truck has a height H, and a beam of light is sent from a source on the bottom of the floor up to a mirror, and it bounces and comes back. All right. So when we say that the physics is the same for everybody, no matter who you are, you have to see that the light is emitted, bounces, and comes back, and it's detected at that spot on the floor. Okay? So everybody has to see that. All right, so first I want to look at this from the point of view of somebody who's actually sitting on the train or truck or whatever it is that's going by. Okay, I'm gonna, again, it's a relativity problem, so the rule of thumb, I mean, probably a postulate from Einstein, you have to have salmon salad in relativity problems. All right? Very important. So, Sam is in this reference frame.
Why are they always on trains?
Because in those days, the trains were the thing. You didn't have trucks. Really? I don't know. I'm trying to be, you know, give you a traditional experience here. So it's got to be Sam and Sally on trains. Don't ask silly questions. All right, so Sam's on the train. Sam has a really spectacular stopwatch and amazing reflexes. Right? So Sam starts his watch as soon as the light is emitted. Don't ask some stupid question like, how does he know the light is emitted? I don't know. That's why we call it a thought experiment, because there are some parts of it we do not think about. Okay, so then it comes back down. Sam clicks his stopwatch as soon as the light hits. So he has timed the flight time of the light in his reference frame. Okay? And we all have we know how velocity is defined. It's simply the distance over time. We define this to be h, so it goes the distance to h and the time that he measures. So we can look at speed of light, if we wish, as 2h over t sand. You good with that? Okay. If you're not, you may run into trouble later in the class. All right. So now we have Sally, as promised. Sally is off to the side of the railroad tracks. And she also has this phenomenal stopwatch and this weird sort of x-ray vision that allows her to know when the light's emitted and when it's detected. Okay. So she starts her clock when the light is emitted. And then it gets a little bit weird because in the time that the light travels up to the roof, Because it travels at a finite speed, the train moves. So from Sally's point of view, the light that gets reflected from the top of the roof has something like this tail. Okay? And then it comes back and hits the floor. So Sally measures the amount of time it takes, from her point of view, for the light to do this. Because the physics is invariant. The physics is the light goes up, hits the ceiling, comes back, hits the floor. Okay? Alright. So Sally measures the time. Sam measures this path. Sally measures that path. Clearly, the distances are different. If, by postulate 1, we say the speed of light has to be the same in both reference frames, clearly the time must be different in the material. Yes?
Why can't you say the distance is different?
We'll do it in a second. The distance is different a little bit. Not transversely, but longitudinally. The transverse distance turns out not. I mean, it isn't. So let's do this analytically and look at the relationship between these two times. Okay? But the essence of it is really just what I painted here. When you demand the speed be the same in each reference frame, the paths by necessity are different. Therefore, the time has to be different. And I really, really hope that bothers you. Okay? Because that's a strange world. Because we just said that time is not absolute. If we all got watches and we synchronized them at the same time, and we left for an hour, and came back, you'd all be coming in the door at different times, depending on what you were doing. Right? If you went to go get a burger in a fast car, you'd be coming in at a different time than you would if you just sort of went out and sat in the lobby and watched. And your watches would all say that you were gone exactly 1 hour. That's really weird. Okay, so let's look at it. Let's look at it from Sally's point of view. From Sally's point of view, this distance is the velocity of the train times the time that she measures. This distance is h. So this distance, which I'm calling d, is going to be, by Pythagorean's theorem, the square root of the square of this distance and that distance. So this is 1/2 dt. I square that, h squared, take the square root. That gives me this distance. So the total path, the total distance that Sally measures, then is going to be 2 times that. So 2 times d divided by t Sally is c in her reference frame. So if I take Sam's measure of c and Sally's measure of c, and I set them equal to one another, which they have to be by Einstein's first postulate, then I can solve algebraically for T Sam in terms of T Sal. So there's a little bit of algebra here, but it's not that algebra. Just for example, if you're you wouldn't say that we can show trivial in here because it's not nearly hard enough for you to be referring to it as trivial and have the right cachet. All right, so you guys got to get that right. All right, so if I solve for Sally in terms of Sam, this is what we get, okay? And there's a lot we can learn from this. Oops. So if we look at this, if v is a speed that's very small compared to the speed of light, the speed of light, if you measure, is about 3 × 10⁶ meters. 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. And so that's pretty fast, and everything in your experience goes much slower than that, except for light itself. So if you are moving with a speed that's very small compared to the speed of light, this number is effectively zero, which means you have 1 over the square root of 1, which is 1, which means that you measure, Sally measures the same time as Sam. And that is the limit in which we exist, which is time is absolute, because you don't see a difference depending on the reference frame. Alright? But if you look at what we just solved for, if this v is a significant fraction of the speed of light, say 0.9, here you would have 0.9 squared, which is now a number that is not negligible. 1 minus that is a number that is smaller than 1. Okay? The square root of that is still smaller than 1. 1 over a number smaller than 1 is now a number bigger than 1. So that would say that Sally's time on her watch would be a number that is bigger than what Sam measured. Okay? So we have this velocity-dependent piece in there. And it can be arbitrarily different, right? If you go really close to the speed of light, this number, which we call the gamma factor, can become infinitely big. So this sounds really wacky. I hope you think it sounds really wacky. Now, is it true? I mean, one of the most obvious things you might do is, can we just take really accurate clocks and leave one sitting here and put one on something that's moving and actually measure this? And sure enough, you can. There are actually many, 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 many tests, many done much with higher precision than this, but in 1971, these dudes took some cesium atomic clocks, very accurate clocks, and left some at the U.S. Naval Observatory, and then took others and flew around the world one way, flew around the world the other way. If you're paying attention, you're thinking, okay, but they're clearly accelerating, so yes, this is really more of a test of general relativity than just special relativity, but nevertheless, they found that they could, that the clocks indeed did disagree when they landed, and that they were able to check that the relativistic corrections made them agree that in fact relativity is true. I actually don't personally know of a physicist that thinks relativity has a problem, but it is our job to test it as much as we can, because that's how science works. So there are lots of tests being done. There are lots of tests being done now, and there are many that have been done historically. I'm not going to bore you with all that, but I am going to give you a name. It's a guy, Clifford Will, who has made a career of really tracking these tests, and he's written some really fabulous review articles through the years. Basically has one really great review article called The Confrontation of General Relativity of Experiment, and he keeps updating it. The last update was 2006, but it's a compendium of a lot of absolutely phenomenal scientific work that was done verifying that relativity worked. So, any thoughts, questions so far? Yes?
Does this require the quantum speed of light constant knowledge?
Question is, does the first postulate, the speed of light is the same in all reference frames, really incorporated in the second postulate, which is sort of said it is the same. Maybe. I have to think about that. That may be So things can get pretty strange. So let's imagine that there is a spaceship flying by Earth at a constant speed of 98% the speed of light. Okay? And astronomers on Earth have a powerful telescope, and they can look in the window of this big spaceship. Okay? And the spaceship, you know, they had a pretty good party, and a baby got born on the spaceship. And when the baby was born, they saw the blue balloon go up in the window of the spaceship. So, you know, it's a boy. Okay, so the astronomers, thinking this was pretty cruel, wrote down the date, right? And then the astronomers kept their eyes on the spaceship, and 70 years went by. This person on the spaceship lived for 70 years, biologically, on that spaceship. And the astronomers on Earth were watching, and they made a note on the calendar when, you know, the wake happened. They could see that everybody dressed in black and singing, okay? And so the question is, if the person lived on the spaceship for 70 years, what was the difference between the calendar times that were written by the astronomers? And so we've got the equipment to do that. There is a subtlety that we'll talk more about, but it is, out of all the reference frames for any given event, there really is one special reference frame. Okay? And that reference frame is the one where the event happens at rest. So in the case of Sam and Sally, those reference frames weren't equivalent with respect to the event. Only one reference frame is on the train, and the event happens in one place. Right? For Sally, it was emitted here and detected there. Right? For Sam, it's emitted and detected in the same space. Okay? On the spaceship, this person is born and dies on the same point in that reference frame. But for the astronomers on Earth, he's born way over there and dies way over there. Okay? So those reference frames are different. The frame of reference where the thing happens at rest is called the proper frame. And so if you look at what we derived with Sam and Sally, what you find is that the time is the shortest in the proper frame. So Sally measured a longer time. Sam is the one who was on the side of Gamma. So this is the proper frame of reference, the spaceship time. So that's where we put our 70 years. This is Gamma, which we put in 0.98 and calculate this. Turns out to be a factor of 5. And so the astronomers on Earth would actually measure, take 350 years. I can't bring you back. I don't know how to do that. Relativity doesn't do that. And again, there's a subtlety, because if you have your twin gets on a spaceship, and then the spaceship has to accelerate. So it's not really just a special relativity problem. It's more complicated than that. Okay. But time travel, yeah, no problem. We deal with it all the time, actually. If you do particle physics, if you're doing anything with satellites, this isn't just academic crap. Your GPS system only works to the accuracy that it does because of relativistic correction. Because effectively what you're doing is you are looking at time differences between satellites. Okay? And you have to take into account that there's acceleration, there's gravitational fields. We'll talk a little bit about that. That's general relativity. And special relativity. And you have to take all that into account in order to have the kind of accuracy it takes to have GPS actually work. And that has actually transformed the world, right? In lots of ways. Certainly it has transformed the world in how you can find your friends and your restaurants, right? But it's a little bit bigger than that, right? It allows us to shift things around from much more of a global society. If you're president, right, you might very well call on a military strike when you believe that you can take some bad dude out. In the old days, maybe you wouldn't, because you knew that there was a high probability that you'd miss the dude and hit some kindergarten, right? But now that probability has changed, and I think it actually changes the political decisions that are made. So the world is really different because of relativity in ways that maybe you don't usually appreciate. Okay? Alright, so if that's not weird enough, we can do the same game. I'll spare you the algebra for right now. But we send the speed of light, we send the light beam from one direction to the other, going that way. So you see these two things and compare them to one another. And when you do this, if you try to measure what is the length, okay, if we know the speed of light and we measure the amount of time it takes for the light to travel from one end to the other, I can determine how long the boxcar is. Sam can do that. Sally can do that. Sally sees this happening. Sam sees that happening. You do the algebra and you relate the two distances they measure. You in fact find that they are different. So that length, space is also relative, at least along the direction of relative motion. So if I have a ball and we're looking at it in two reference frames that are not moving with respect to one another, then it would look round. But if we now take that ball and, you know, some pitcher throws it really, really fast, and we're at rest, and that ball goes flying through, and we now measure, we look at that ball, depending on the speed, in fact, we would find this dimension contracted, so that the ball would look more like a pancake. Issues of space as well. In this case, we again have a special frame of reference, which is where the ball is at rest. We call that the proper frame. And relative to that proper frame, along the length of motion, along the direction of motion, length is contracted in any other reference frame. So if you measure a certain length in the frame where it's at rest, the proper frame, if I were to measure from any other frame of reference, which is moving with respect to that, I would measure that length to be shorter. So we have time dilation and length contraction relative to the proper frame. It's contracted by a factor of gamma, just like the time is dilated by a factor of gamma. Now, of course, we're not limited to things only happening in space or only happening in time. So we have to worry about the more general case. And we call these things Lorentz transformations. And you may wonder why we might not call it Hubble. Basically, the question is, if I have something that happens at a certain three-dimensional point in time, in space, and at a certain time, how do I relate that x, y, z, and t to this x prime, y prime, z prime, and t prime observed by somebody else is moving with respect to that initial vector at some velocity.
So we'll derive this, but there's a relationship between the x, y, z's and the primes, which are given by these equations,
called the Lorentz transformation, because in fact, they're known before Einstein. People actually thought weird things, like physically things really did shrink in a certain direction they were moving, and there were some pretty bizarre ideas out there. But so Einstein brought clarity, but actually a lot of the stuff that went into special relativity was stuff that was actually already known. Anyway, what you see here is that the position isn't the gamma factor, depends on the position and the time in the other reference frame. And the time measured in a certain reference frame depends on the position and the time in the other reference frame. Okay. So if that really doesn't seem weird enough for you, think about it a little bit harder. The where I measure something depends on the where and the time in the other reference frame. How much time depends on that velocity. So what you see is that space and time get all mixed up in these transformations. They're not the independent, immutable, three spatial dimensions marching through time as if the space and the time are totally independent beasts. Because they get all mixed up. So we can't really talk about space and time. We have to talk about space-time. So we're just talking about space and time right now, but of course physicists measure, or we experience things other than just lengths and times, right? We can measure all sorts of stuff out there. Any physical measurable that you can do in one reference frame, you can do in some other reference frame. So a complete theory of the universe really has to take into account transformations of whatever it is that you measure in one reference frame to whatever it is you would measure in another reference frame. And so we would say that's making the theory relativistic. Okay? And so we have to have relativistic transformations for anything that you can measure. It turns out that momentum and energy have the same relationship mathematically in transformations from one reference frame to another as do space and time. That in fact the momentum in some reference frame depends on the momentum and the energy in another reference frame. Okay, in exactly the same form as we had earlier. So it's the same Lorentz transformation for the momentum energy. Now momentum is really mass times velocity, so it contains mass. So we're going to derive this, but basically what it's telling you is that you can think of mass as a form of energy. Okay, and this is sort of what boils down to where Einstein got E equals mc squared, so we'll do that more formally next week. And of course that's turned out to be very important for us. And maybe that's a good place for me to stop. Do you have any questions? Alright, so this is very conceptual, so we're gonna be more analytical. As I say, I'll post the next lecture on the web. Yes.
You need your clickers.
Do you need your clickers? Are you required to buy your clickers? Yeah. You know, the problem with the clickers is unless
I make a big deal about it and use them to take attendance or something, and people stop for me, and now I'll do a clicker problem and six people will have their clickers. So I sort of have gotten it where I'll do it informally. I mean, I will do clicker-like things, but I'm probably not going to use the clickers. The electronic book online, which you're free to do. There's also something called Mastering Physics, which you may want to do, which has lots of exercises and stuff on it you may find useful. It also has lots of nice demos. I may use some of them for you. I was pondering whether I was going to actually do homework online and require you to do that, Mastering Physics, and I think I've decided not to do